Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for the 10th of October. I'm Krupa Party. On the programme, Palestinian officials in Gaza say approximately 200,000 people have so far returned to the north of the territory since the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas took effect earlier in the day. We'll hear from people inside the Gaza Strip, and we hear from a former US commander in the region on whether the Trump administration can police a lasting ceasefire. Plus, reaction to the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize that's been awarded to Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who campaigned against Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro in last year's election. It is one which international observers accuse Maduro of rigging in his favour. And could the Prime Minister's trade talks with India see more Bollywood blockbusters being made on British soil? That's all coming up. It's believed some 200,000 Palestinians have already returned to Gaza's north as the first phase of US President Donald Trump's ceasefire plan comes into effect. It means Israeli forces have withdrawn from areas that right up until this morning were scenes of intense fighting. Many making the journey on foot know little of what, if anything, is left of their homes. They carry with them what few belongings they have and a huge sense of relief. As the IDF pulls back, Hamas security forces have stepped into the streets to fill a security vacuum. But behind the smiles and peace signs to the camera, there is acute fatigue, a dire humanitarian crisis, and families mourning the loss of their loved ones. At least 67,000 people have been killed since the war began 2 years ago. Yusra Abu Sharek is an aid worker who was displaced from Gaza City. She sent us this voice note just after the ceasefire came into force.
Just a few minutes before the IDF confirmed people could return to the Gaza City, and they withdrew from Al-Rashid Coastal Road. So we are so excited for this time to be permanent and for the recent displacement that we were going through to be the last displacement ever. People are so excited, so glad that they could make it back to Gaza City, especially in north, and people are trying to figure out what happens to their houses, and some of them went back to Gaza City and north on foot. So imagine, like, they will walk for at least 3 hours just to check the situation there for their houses or their neighborhoods. We are so optimistic, hopeful, but still so cautious.
Optimistic, but cautious, and perhaps rightly so, because Gazans have found themselves in this situation before, thinking a ceasefire would last only to be displaced once more. People like Fadi Abed, before the war started, he had graduated as a dentist with big dreams. Since then, his home in Gaza City has been destroyed, and he's currently living in Al-Mawasi, further south near Khan Yunis. He isn't sure exactly when he and his family will make that journey back north.
At this time, we're not that optimistic about going back, unfortunately. For my family, they're still waiting. They're hesitating that all this war thing is going to go back. And it was like a very heavy financially to go back and forth in Gaza City and then to the south. So we're just delaying that decision until we're 100% sure.
Meanwhile, inside Israel, the clock is ticking. The first phase of the peace plan demands the release of all the remaining 48 Israeli hostages by midday local time on Monday. It is a hugely testing time for the hostage families, unsure of the condition of their loved ones. The BBC World Service's Tim Franks has travelled to Jerusalem, where he'll be covering the implementation of this agreement and the expected release of hostages for the world tonight. I caught up with him before the programme and asked him how people in Israel were reacting now that the first steps of the agreement have been implemented.
I think, Krupa, that there's a tremendous sense of expectation that the hostages, dead and alive, are going to be released, assuming that nothing falls to pieces between now and the 72-hour window in which this is supposed to happen, and that there is a sense that the nightmare for many people in Israel, obviously for those who are more intimately connected with those who were taken hostage, I mean, the nightmare barely comes to terms with it. But for a lot of people in Israel, it's been the sort of the most obvious emblem of the continuing trauma of October the 7th. So in a sense, the expectation around that is that once that happens, people will be able to exhale. There'll be a sigh of relief that at least that part of the trauma is over. I think there isn't, from what I can gather, a sense of sort of overweening euphoria. I think people are exhausted. People have been traumatized. People are also angry. They're angry, not all of them, but the opinion polls suggest that a fairly sizable majority are pretty angry with the way in which the government has handled this war. And I think there's also exhaustion more broadly in, you know, the fact that Israel is, it's a conscript army, and, you know, there have been tens of thousands of reservists who've been called up for hundreds of days during this war. And I think there is a sense that this has been a war which has taken a real toll on people in Israel. And beyond that, I think there's also uncertainty about what comes next. There is an understanding that Israel may be very strong in one sense, but it has also become increasingly isolated globally.
That anger and exhaustion you talk of brings to mind a couple of comments that have grabbed my attention over the past day or so. One being in Gaza, that there is no life left in us, and another from Israel saying you don't get points for bringing home hostages in bags. It really is a rollercoaster of emotions for people on both sides. And now we have that list of some 250 Palestinian prisoners who are due to be released in exchange for the hostages published by Israel. Now we now have that list. How likely are there to be complications with this?
It's difficult to say whether there will be complications. I mean, I think that the list is going to be haggled over to an extent. I mean, how much it will change, I can't quite say. But the fact that there will not be certain names on there that Hamas wanted, I think that they will push back. How much leeway they have on that, I really don't know. I don't think, my best guess is that there won't be that much back and forth on it. I also think that what happens in terms of the objections that some Israelis can bring to the courts about the names on this list, because, you know, they may well be relatives of people who have been killed as a result of the actions that some of these convicted prisoners took, the killings that they carried out or that they directed. I think that is unlikely to derail things as well. But from what we understand, some of the names that Hamas wanted and perhaps even expected are not there. But nonetheless, there will be some prisoners who will be released. And it always happens with Israel when it comes to these big prisoner releases, often in conjunction with things like hostage swaps, is that it is incredibly painful, because these are people who have, in Israel's terms and many Israelis' terms, been the worst of the worst terrorists. And there is a fear that, as with what happened back in 2011 when 1,000 prisoners were released in exchange for Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier, one of the Palestinian prisoners who was released was Yahya Sinwar, who then went on to become the military leader of Hamas. So there is concern about that, but I think there is also an understanding in Israel that this is a deal that simply has to be done.
Tim Franks for us there. Well, on Monday, President Trump is expected to travel to Israel, but he won't be the only American heading there. 200 US troops from the US Central Command, that is the part of the US military that covers the Middle East, will also be deployed to Israel to monitor the implementation of the ceasefire. Retired four-star General Joseph Votel was commander of CENTCOM in Donald Trump's first term between 2016 and 2019, and he joins me now. Thank you for your time. General Votel, firstly, tell me what you know about which US military personnel will be deployed to Israel and what they'll be doing there.
Yes, thank you. It's always good to be with the BBC. So what I think we know is that these forces, this 200 person group, will likely come from forces already assigned to the United States Central Command, as we saw in Lebanon last year, after the the engagement with Hezbollah. They came from Special Operations Command of Central Command, and so we should expect that they will come from one of the existing components that are under CENTCOM. They will likely include some leadership, but it will also, I think, include very robust staff presence. They'll be focused on tasks like planning, like coordinating transportation, coordinating security, logistics, engineering, and really trying to get their hands around the current situation. So I think we'll learn more in the coming days here, but I think we'll see them deploy relatively rapidly from forces that are already assigned to CENTCOM.
To what extent, if at all, do you believe that this suggests that there is a concern within the US administration that Israel will need to be, shall we say, encouraged to stick to this process?
Well, I don't know about that or not. I mean, there certainly are some political and diplomatic aspects to this, but I think what has been realized by the president, by the administration here, is that in order to see this very challenging 20-point plan implemented, is that it is going to require skin in the game, as we would say here, and that is presence on the ground, in this case in Israel, and a commitment to make sure that what's been agreed to can actually be moved. Can be moved forward on. So I actually think the deployment of these forces is more about trying to implement the agreement than it is about trying to send a message to Israel. Although I recognize it could be a dual purpose here to this.
Are you concerned at all about any potential risks to these personnel?
Well, I think we always have to be concerned about the military forces when they're deployed away from their home countries here. And so, yes, I am generally concerned about that. It looks like they will initially be positioned in Israel. Israel is largely certainly a very stable area, and it will be in the interests of the Israeli government to make sure that our military forces are safeguarded and protected while they're implementing this this agreement. So while I always have concern about this, I think this is probably, we're probably able to do this at a very manageable level of risk. Mm.
And briefly, I wonder whether you think Israel's strike on Hamas inside Qatar, where there's also a major US CENTCOM base, made the difference in getting President Trump to push for this ceasefire?
Yeah, I think that it probably did. I think perhaps the United States and certainly a number of our partners across the region and internationally were surprised by that strike in Doha and in kind of a diplomatic enclave and against those that were actually involved in the negotiation process. Our president was very clear on that. Certainly a number of our international partners were. And I think out of this, Qatar actually gained some leverage. I mean, they got an apology out of this. They've got a security commitment from the United States out of this. And I think that's put them in a position where they could play, along with the administration, with our president, play a very leading role in this agreement.
General Joseph Votel, we thank you for your time. Coming up later, 80 years since the launch of Radio 4's Today in Parliament, we reflect on the historic moments captured on the programme.
I must say that part of his speech was rather like being savaged by a dead sheep.
No. Yeah. No. Yeah. No.
That's in just less than 20 minutes' time. While US President Trump has already listed Gaza as the eighth war that he has resolved since returning to the White House, and he's not been shy about his desire to win a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. At one point, he even declared by saying, "Everyone says I should get it." It was, however, not to be, this year at least. Earlier in the day, we learned that the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who campaigned against Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro in last year's election, one which international observers accused Maduro of rigging in his own favour. On the streets of Caracas, many people welcomed the decision, including Victoria, a student.
No me lo creí en principio porque I didn't believe it at first because I was on my way to work, and then I saw the news and it was like my brain short-circuited. It was incredible. For me personally, I think it means it's like a sure sign that, okay, in Venezuela they didn't recognize the vote the way they should, but that the world sees and confirms the work that she's done for years. The world recognizes it. It's a sign for all the Venezuelans who cast their vote for change that they can now once again believe in that.
But the award isn't entirely without controversy, since Machado has herself endorsed the actions of US President Trump in attacking boats, mostly Venezuelan ones, alleged to be smuggling drugs in the Caribbean. Our colleague James Menendez interviewed her just last week and asked her directly whether he supported, or whether she supported rather, a US-backed regime change of the Maduro government.
Regime change was already mandated by the people in presidential elections under terrible, extreme conditions. But we not only won by a landslide, but we proved our victory. We certainly need to break down the repressive apparatus. And in order to do that, we do need the international community to support us and Maduro to understand that his only option right now is accept the terms of a peaceful transition, that he has to go. He won't go unless he realizes there's a credible threat, that things are going to get worse every day that goes by for them. So the cost of staying in power by force is higher than the cost of accepting the terms of a negotiated transition.
So you are in favor of a diplomatic solution then?
It's not enough. And that's why I do agree. I totally support with the international deployment and coalition that's working in the Caribbean to stop the flow of illegal drug income to the regime.
I mean, we've seen the three boats destroyed. Would you support strikes on land in Venezuela, again, in the name of tackling those drugs gangs? I mean, you seem to be talking about putting so much pressure on Nicolas Maduro that he's forced to come to a negotiated solution. But can you just be clear about what that force entails?
Diplomatic pressure has not worked. So we need strength and we need the regime to understand that the Venezuelan people are not alone.
Maria Corina Machado speaking to the BBC's James Menendez there. Well, I've been speaking to Christopher Sabatini, who is a Latin America expert at Chatham House. And I asked him firstly to outline Machado's political career.
Maria Corina Machado started as a civil society activist. She formed a group that was dedicated to electoral integrity called Sumite. A few years later, she shifted to politics and was elected as a National Assembly member. What propelled her to her current prominence and the reward of being a Nobel Prize laureate was her commitment to the elections in 2024. What happened was the Biden administration had tried to incentivize and push for elections in 2024, and the opposition organized a primary in which she was selected overwhelmingly by 90% of the vote to be the opposition's presidential candidate. She was shortly afterwards banned from participating because of the Maduro Supreme Court prohibited her on spurious charges. But she threw her weight behind a stand-in candidate, and she became really the face of the opposition at a time when Venezuelans were fed up with the repression, the economic collapse, and she became sort of the public face of the demand for popular change. Those elections were stolen, and she competed very vigorously and bravely in bringing people to the streets, and then afterwards trying to bring people to the streets to protest those stolen elections. And that is basically why she has become really sort of a symbolic figure.
President Trump has certainly openly courted the Nobel Peace Prize. How much might the committee have kept that in mind and just explain that relationship? Because she does have the support of President Trump, doesn't she?
As you say, Donald Trump coveted this Nobel Peace Prize. He deeply wanted it. And the first statement from the White House was that the Nobel Prize committee favored politics over peace. And I think in part, this was an effort to appease the Donald Trump administration to say, well, maybe you're not quite ready for a peace prize, but we do think and support the efforts of individuals, heroic individuals that you have embraced and who have embraced your policies for the cause of democratic institutions and rights.
We heard in an interview just a moment ago by our World Service colleague that she is seemingly relaxed about the possibility of a US overthrow of Maduro. And again, going back to what you just said, there are some who go as far as to say that the award going to her throws the credibility of the award into question.
It's a good question. I mean, she has, as have many members of the Venezuelan opposition, long advocated for a military overthrow of the Nicolas Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, in the name of democracy. That, by any other name, would be a coup. But the truth is, and I think she demonstrated this very courageously last year, is that the opportunities for democratic change, for electoral change, have been closed off.
Christopher Sabatini from Chatham House there. Next, if there is one place to capture reaction to developments on the Indian subcontinent here in the UK, may they be political, cricket related or otherwise, Southall in West London may be it. It's long been home to a vibrant Asian community, some of whom arrived back in the 1950s to take up factory jobs near Heathrow Airport. And it's where I headed earlier in the day for a look at Keir Starmer's visit to India to secure greater business and trade ties. Under the deal struck, the UK will cut taxes on goods imported from India, including clothing and jewellery, while India will reduce duties on the import of products such as Scotch whisky, medical devices and luxury cars. But the Prime Minister also announced three new Bollywood movies by India's leading film production company, Yash Raj Films, and that they will be entirely made here in the UK from next year. The Apna Punjab restaurant in Southall has become a favourite for Bollywood celebrities rather visiting the UK. And I've been speaking to its owner, Inder Mahemi, who told me why so many Bollywood stars like to eat there and what this deal might mean for his business.
Inder?
Yes, yes.
Nice to meet you, Inder Agrupa.
Thank you.
That is such a lovely because Indian warm welcome. Do you want to eat first?
Yeah, because it's lunch time.
Let's talk first.
Yeah.
So how has this dinky little restaurant, only about 20 odd seats in has this restaurant, which sits amongst so many Indian restaurants here in Southall, how have you become the hub of Bollywood celebrities?
It's the taste and the service.
Oh, really? And yeah, what's so special about it?
The quality we provide is very high quality. The chef we brought from India, 5-star hotels. You know, within 4 years, I have completed more than 100 plus movies, 150 plus songs.
Why don't you give us a bit of a tour,
Inder? Okay.
Just heading down a couple of steps here to what looks like a very functional and already busy kitchen. Well, let's talk about developments this week because the Prime Minister has been in India.
Yes.
He's announced an array of trade deals, but one of them is this commitment to three major Yash Chopra films being made here in the UK. What is your reaction to that?
You know, we will get more business and then our supplier will be busy. The whole circle will be busy. My all veg guy, the meat guy, everybody will get the job. So it's good for us. We are happy. We already booked the business for next year, and this Yash Raj Chopra is like a big production company in India. It's a huge, they're going to bring like a multi-million worth business. It's not a small business, you know.
So this is exciting news for you.
We are ready.
And clearly they come to you for the food. There's pictures up in your little restaurant of people.
Yes,
why don't you give me a bit of a tour? Who's been to your restaurant? I want to know. I saw a couple of Bollywood stars I know. So that's you with Akshay Kumar, who is a big star in India.
Yeah, then Diljit Dosanjh, very famous actor.
Diljit Dosanjh, who has been playing with Ed Sheeran.
Yes, yes. Roshan Prince from Punjab, Varun Dhawan.
Okay, so here is a question.
Yeah.
Who have you not hosted and who are you hoping this new deal will bring to your restaurant?
Now we are hoping for Shah Rukh Khan and Salman Khan.
Oh, you want the big names.
Yeah, they are coming.
Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is Keir Starmer said that the visa rules between India and the UK would not be changing, and that was not discussed, and there are no changes there. Is there conversation about that? Was the subject of visas, is that something that has come up?
When they are bringing big production movies, they should, you know, issue the visa as soon as possible. So so many movies I have seen that the artist date is not available. That's the big issue.
Well, that leaves me with only one more question. What are we eating?
Eating today, number one is kulcha thali.
Yes.
And the most famous soya cham. That's our famous dish here.
Perfect. Looking forward to it.
And that was Inder Mahemi from the Apna Punjab restaurant in Southall. The main headlines so far on the world tonight. Palestinian officials say 200,000 displaced people have returned to the north of Gaza after the Israeli military confirmed that the ceasefire agreement with Hamas had come into effect. The French President Emmanuel Macron has asked Sébastien Lecornu to return as Prime Minister only 4 days after he stood down. And President Trump has said that the US will impose an additional 100% tariffs on imports from China after it further restricted exports from rare earth minerals. Next, we are continuing to keep across party conference season, turning our attention to Plaid Cymru, which kicked off today in Swansea. The conference comes as the party prepares for the next Welsh parliamentary election in May, where they'll be facing stiff competition, not just from Labour, but also from Nigel Farage's Reform Party. After his opening speech, the Plaid Cymru leader, Rhinab Iorwerth, spelt out where he saw the biggest challenge to his party.
And we need change now in Wales. Labour have dropped off the cliff in terms of their polling in Wales. It's becoming abundantly clear that it's a choice between progression and vision under Plaid Cymru or division and regression under Reform. It's my job over the next 7 months to point out what the real risks are of going in one direction and what the real opportunities and hope are of people putting their faith in Plaid Cymru.
Iorwerth used his speech to promise universal free childcare in Wales and presented Plaid Cymru as the radical choice. I asked BBC Wales political editor Gareth Lewis just how radical they're being.
Whether it's radical or not is open to debate. They would argue that some of their policies, like a child payment for the poorest families, the policy they've announced today, which is a much improved childcare offer, are radical. But there is an element of steady as she goes too. The pitch is that Plaid Cymru is ready to replace Labour as the party of government in Wales, that they're a government in waiting and the only credible alternative. There is perhaps a mood in Wales at the moment for change. Plaid's job to convince voters that they're the best vehicle for that. And they also, with that in mind, want to warn voters off Reform too. I have to say, though, for all that talk of wanting to replace Labour, they might actually need Labour after the election were they to be the biggest party. No one is likely to get a majority. So anyone who wins would perhaps need support from elsewhere to pass a budget. Although perhaps a hint today from Plaid that they would be prepared to go it alone as a minority government were they to win enough seats.
And you've touched on it there. The polling suggests that there is not much between Reform and Plaid Cymru. Is Plaid considered to be the only party that might be seen to be able to beat Reform there?
Well, I think Labour would probably fancy their chances as well, depending on who you speak to. Some in Labour say that perhaps they're being a little undersold at the moment in the polls, but certainly a picture emerging of Plaid, Reform and Labour vying for that biggest party position next year. The other thing to pick up as well on is independence. It's obviously the raison d'etre for Plaid Cymru. They want an independent Wales. They're taking, though, under Rhinab Iorwerth, a far more pragmatic approach than they have in the past. In 2021, under his predecessor, Adam Price, there was the promise of a referendum on independence within 5 years if they won that Senate election. There's nothing like that this time. Rhinab Iorwerth is saying that he wants to kickstart the debate on independence if Plaid were to end up being the biggest party and running that government after next May. It's your call, he said today in his conference speech. There's a risk in that, of course, because whilst they might attract voters in to replace Labour and beat Reform next year, they might find that persuading voters of the merit of independence, if we look at the polling on that, that would actually be a much trickier task.
And that was the analysis of our BBC Wales political editor, Gareth Lewis, there. Well, Plaid wasn't the only party to make major policy announcements at a conference this week. Conservatives are still dissecting their party leader's speech on Wednesday when Kemi Badenoch pledged to abolish stamp duty and presented her party as the only fiscally responsible option. Well, with only the SNP left to hold its own event beginning tomorrow, how has a party conference season altered the political lay of the land when Parliament resumes on Monday? Gerry Scott is Assistant Political Editor at The Times and joins us now. Good to have you with us, Gerry.
Good evening.
Good evening. Have we seen any evidence that Kemi Badenoch's speech has stabilised her position in her party and her party in the polls?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think on the first question, if the aim of Kemi Badenoch was to get out of conference being still the party leader, not having faced a leadership challenge and having put some meat on the bones of kind of her vision for the Conservative Party going forward, then I think, yes, that was pretty successful for her. But that's very kind of, it's very easy to get caught up in this conference season bubble when you're kind of, you know, in these large windowless rooms in a city somewhere in Britain, to think that actually this has gone down very well with party members, but what does it mean on the outside? So I think in the polls, not so much, but I think she has really solidified her position for now, for the next few months, in her leadership role.
Meat on the bones of policies, because there has been real criticism of her not being in any particular rush to announce new policies, and certainly no further details.
Yeah, that's right. And look, that was on purpose. What Comey Badenoch said when she came in as leader is she said that she wanted to take time to go back to first principles. The criticism of that has been that whilst the Conservatives haven't been presenting policy, that void has been filled by Reform UK on the right, and that they have been able to put their policies forward. You've had the Conservatives saying, well, they're nicking our policy. Well, fine, but it's been pretty quiet on the kind of Tory front. So I think members, cabinet members, MPs were very pleased to see some policy announced. And it was really a kind of conference of two halves in some way. The first half dedicated to migration, that announcement we had that the Tories would leave the ECHR if they were in power. And then the second half really focused on economic responsibility, setting themselves up for the future, and of course that big announcement on the scrapping stamp duty as well. So it really was a bit of a conference of two halves, and one that I think, you know, Kemi Badenoch will go away feeling pretty happy about.
You talked in your first answer about that gap between what members are feeling and really how that translates to the public. I wonder whether you feel party conferences really change anything. Will anyone be going back to Parliament on Monday with a spring in their step thanks to how well they did at their party conference?
I think what it can change is kind of the vibe of a party. And, you know, for example, take the Tory conference. Robert Jenrick was on his best behaviour, I would say. So whilst Comey Badenoch might have faced some kind of leadership challenge in the next few months, I don't think that's going to happen. But again, watch this space when we get to the local elections in May. It's quite damaging. And the same with Labour. You know, Andy Burnham was there kind of challenging Keir Starmer and the government in many, many ways. But actually what happened is that meant a kind of groundswell of support for Keir Starmer within his MPs, those who are pretty critical of him in private. So I think both main party leaders at their conferences have kind of solidified their base for now. But like I say, when people get back to Westminster or their constituencies and start hearing from people about the problems they're facing, that's a whole different story.
Gerry Scott, Assistant Political Editor at The Times. Very good to have you with us here on the programme. Let's stay with the subject of British politics, because this week marks 80 years since the very first broadcast of Today in Parliament on the BBC. Over the years, it has captured some of the most theatrical, surprising and dramatic moments in British politics. And someone who's been there for many of those moments is Mark Darcy, former presenter of the programme for 21 years and now co-presenter of the Hansard Society's Parliament Matters podcast. He's been telling me about the early days of the programme, which began back in 1945.
For a start, there was no audio available of proceedings in the Commons. They'd basically sort of write down almost a transcript of it, or detailed notes of what was said in the Commons and the Lords. And that would then be read out by an announcer. So it was a very kind of high fibre program to listen to, because it was just one voice going through all the things that happened on a given day in Parliament.
And then fast forward then 30-odd years, 1978, and we have the first broadcasting of Parliament that takes place, and that meant debates could be listened to firsthand. How significant a change was that?
Well, there was a lot of worry at the time that people would, if not play to the cameras, then play to the microphones. And I think it did happen a little bit.
It may be my imagination, but I am under the impression that questions and answers have been longer today, and I cannot understand the reason why.
If you listen back now to the audio of, you know, question times in the era of James Callaghan and Margaret Thatcher in the late 70s, it was much more sedate affair, usually.
There have been undoubtedly countless dramatic moments in Parliament, and you touched on one of them there, that being when the Jim Callaghan government collapsed live on radio.
Yes, absolutely. There was this enormous debate. I'm afraid I'm old enough to have listened to it at the time. There was this enormous no-confidence motion brought by Margaret Thatcher. You got to this incredibly dramatic moment where the result was announced, and actually it was by one vote the Callaghan government fell.
The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 310.
Just the most extraordinary powerful moment for the House of Commons. It could throw out a government.
And Mark, it was during the 1990s that we got our first female Speaker of the Commons, Betty Boothroyd.
Betty Boothroyd was generally regarded as an absolutely fabulous speaker. And there's a marvellous moment where she delivers this absolutely searing put-down to a Conservative MP called Michael Mates, who's trying to talk about what is still at that point a live court case. And Betty Boothroyd more or less nukes him from the chair when he won't stay within the rules.
I would ask the Honourable Gentleman to re-look at his notes and to see that this House is given the information he wished it to have, which is not sub judice and which cannot be used in a future trial.
There's always interesting stuff happening in Parliament. I mean, short of being on Test Match Special, I couldn't imagine a better job in radio than that. I was starting to work there at about the time that the whole Iraq crisis was beginning to crystallise, and Tony Blair had to get a vote of the Commons to secure British participation. And that was a vote no one was quite sure how it was going to go.
It concludes that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons, that Saddam has continued to produce them, that he has existing and active military plans for the use of chemical and biological weapons, which could be activated within 45 minutes.
A bit later on, you've got stuff like Brexit, the level of tension, the fragmentation of party lines, the internal dramas. It was just amazing to sit on the side of, but it was actually quite exhausting. All sorts of other moments in there. I mean, one that particularly sticks with me is Boris Johnson at the height of the Partygate crisis, when he was dealing with the allegations, later proven, that he had been holding illegal lockdown rule-breaking parties in Downing Street. And there was a Conservative MP called Aaron Bell, described how he'd gone to his grandmother's funeral. It had been a socially distanced funeral. No one had been able to hug. They hadn't been able to stay for a cup of tea afterwards. And the House was sort of nodding along with this account. And quite suddenly, he sort of lashed out.
Does the Prime Minister think I'm a fool?
No, Mr. Speaker. And I want to thank my honourable friend. And I want to say how deeply I sympathise with him and his family.
And you can see Boris Johnson almost physically flinch.
And what many people might not know is that this is a show that the BBC is mandated to broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, that dates all the way back to the wartime years. The wartime coalition government under Winston Churchill wanted to give a bit more focus to the importance of Parliament because it was in a war with dictators. The Labour government actually wrote into the BBC's charter, which was being renewed as the war ended, that the BBC should have a specific role in covering Parliament. And so Today in Parliament is the result of that.
Mark Darcy on 80 years of Today in Parliament on the BBC. Just time for our closing headlines. Palestinian officials in Gaza say approximately 200,000 people have so far returned to the north of the territory since the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas took effect earlier today. Israeli forces have pulled back to an agreed position, and under the terms of the agreement, Hamas now has until Monday morning to release all the remaining Israeli hostages. The UN says more aid has started getting into Gaza, but not yet at the scale needed. That is it from the world tonight. This is Krupa Party from me and everyone here on the programme. Good night and have a great weekend.
Studio direction was by Chris Lovelock. The editor was Matthew Symington.